Chapter 9. Haveya. Haveya Mundi, one of Hugh's much-feared intervention board, wore clothes badly. It was as though they weren't quite right for his size or shape. It was a common colonial problem, born of too many generations of malnourishment and unreliable manufacturing. Make do and mend. Even with an orbital office over Berlinhof, Haveya's tunics still seemed as ill-fitting as an itinerant spacer's. That he had a face designed by evolution for suspicious and mistrustful expressions had perhaps exercised some form of determinism, because he had ended up in a suspicious and mistrustful job. His features were gaunt and hollow, hung off big slanting cheekbones. Above them, his narrow eyes seemed to question everything. In his career at the Intervention Board, familiarly known as Mordant House, because of the planet-side district their office had once inhabited, and because it sounded just sinister enough, he had driven three subordinates to confess misdeeds they hadn't even guessed at, just by sharing a room with them. Today, Haveya wasn't feeling too sinister. He was looking forward to getting to grips with some unchallenging intel reports on a smuggling operation. A cartel had been bringing the hegemonic drug Esh into a handful of colony worlds, and he suspected preventing it was a lost cause. Still, his job was to do, not to set policy, and current policy was to draw a hard border and try to control access to the stuff. Midway through his morning, though, he was called in by Chief Larry. She was hunched like a spider in an A-grav chair behind her desk. Her brittle boned limbs were like narrow pipes, slightly thicker at the elbows and knees. Her neural link threw images and holograms across her desk as she addressed him. "Might have a problem at Huey Kavor." Haveya gave his chief a look. "The hegemony takeover isn't new, surely. We can't do anything about it, unless we really do want to butt heads with the Esiel." Some of the more nativist in the department had been pushing for just that. Hugh should take a stand against these damn aliens poaching their colonies. "It's not the hegemony, believe it or not." Larry's head shifted on her fragile neck, and more information began to appear over the desk. "A ship just brought in a packet from a Huey Kavor informer. Supposedly something special docked at an orbital there. Undercover, but someone reckoned they could make a little largesse by selling us the news." Haveya was scanning through the report. "More architect gossip. This is nonsense." "Almost certainly. And not the first time someone's tried to spread this particular rumour," Larry agreed, then paused expectantly. "I thought they were going to repeal Standing Order 4, Haveya complained eventually, when he saw which way this was going. "Still in committee," Larry agreed with a thin smile. "Likely it'll be done by the time you return from Huey Kavor. Then they'll use it as a reason not to pay you overtime." Standing Order 4 came out of the period when any rumour of the architect's return had caused immediate panic. Whole teams of Mordant House agents had been dispatched by the swiftest routes at vast expense. But those days were past, and Hugh was seeking to cut back on costs. Crack squads of veterans, led by hard-faced people like Haveya, cost money, especially when they kicked in doors, kidnapped and interrogated witnesses, boarded ships, and almost set off whole chains of subsidiary wars in their fervour. Apparently, someone had seen a salvage crew drag in a wreck that looked like it had been architected. Haveya shrugged inwardly. A ship could explode in a variety of ways. You could get some pretty spectacular effects if a gravitic drive went wrong in the instant of transit. And these days, who'd ever seen an architect's handiwork firsthand? He already had his final report half composed in his head before he stood up. On Larry's desk, the details of his birth to Hui Kavor flashed up. He frowned. "This looks a bit roughshod," he said uncertainly. Roughshod was an old operational term, combining the word's actual meaning with rough and slipshod. It was the way the service used to operate back in the old days. You got things done, however, and lived with the discomfort. They were shipping him out on a Castigar vessel, which made scant concessions to human passengers. It was definitely the quickest way to Hui Kavor, using one of their near-mindless savant-caste navigators to speed them through the deep void. "Chief, is there something I'm not seeing here about this job?" Larry held his gaze, expressionless. "On paper, of course not. Just another nonsense fire we need to stamp out. Just come back and tell us we don't need to worry about it, Hevea."
"And off paper?"
She shut off the holographic display, and he knew that she'd also killed the recording of their meeting. "The Harbinger Ash is involved," she said. Hevea wasn't important enough to have met Ash, but he knew it was still around, ageless and pointless in equal measure. Yet it kept turning up, and sometimes it said something. When it did, you listened.
"I didn't need to hear that," he muttered.
"You haven't, not officially. Just a routine mission." His heart was speeding, and he had his internal dispenser give him a shot for it.
"I'll go pack then, Chief."
The Castigar woke him at Hui Kavor, just in time for him to discover everything had already gone mad. Even being shipped roughshod through the deep void hadn't been quick enough for him to get ahead of this. The Castigar ship's bridge was a tube, inclined at 45 degrees and half submerged in milky liquid. The worm-shaped aliens lounged in fat loops on the slope, their many-limbed heads buried in their instrumentation. A human-style display was set towards the high end of the space for his benefit, because industry-caste Castigar tended to be helpful to a fault. The Hui Kavor system was in uproar, the hegemony takeover almost forgotten. Hevea's target had arrived unnoticed, the ship hidden within a coffin transport. However, when the Vulture God left Lungcrow Station at speed, it had apparently been towing an architect's leavings, there for all to see. Further investigation revealed that the ship had used force to escape the station, leaving a wake of deaths behind it, including station staff and the ship's own crew. Nobody was sure who controlled the vessel now. Speculation abounded. He looked at the recorded Vulture God and its twisted cargo, cross-referenced the images on his slate to wartime wrecks. He gave himself another shot to slow his heart. All around him, the Castigar were flashing warning colours across their slick, segmented bodies, twining their tail tips together in agitation. The air stank with the acrid scent of their worry. He was entirely in agreement with them. He contacted the handful of Hugh and Mordant informers on Lungcrow and sent them his credentials, requesting full cooperation and an introduction to station admin. He'd have to hope that Hugh Ritt still carried some weight, despite the recent regime change. Then the Castigar craft was spiralling in towards the station, its speaker delegate requesting docking permission. Hevea Mundi retrieved his dossiers and reviewed his knowledge of the Vulture God and its crew. Chris. After their arrest, Chris had expected them to be framed for the security staff's deaths. She'd already prepared legal arguments by the time his wisdom, the bearer, Sathiel, pitched up at their cell. Part of her was numb, after seeing Barney and Medvig die. However, she was still the crew's lawyer, and she had to protect them. Sathiel changed all of that, and it didn't hurt that he was pushing his own interests as well. He had a serious throwdown with station admin, accusing Leng of trying to hide the truth about the architects. He also took responsibility for the Vulture's crew being in the cargo bay, and Leng was plainly unwilling to arrest him or his people. Everyone ended up being turfed out of her offices onto the street. Sathiel rushed off to capitalise on what he had, given that the actual evidence had been whisked away from him. The Vulture crew, if that was what they even were anymore, were left abandoned as the station resounded with the agitation of people still getting to grips with a possible return of everyone's worst nightmare.
"Right," said Rollo,
and led them off to do their duty, to drink, brood, and toast their lost companions.
"Masoku Barnier,"
Rollo said somberly. They'd muscled everyone else out of an alcove in the nearest bar, and now he stood while they sat. Even Solace, who'd never been at a spacer's wake before.
"Born 92 after," he declared to them. "On Tsiolkovsky orbital over Lumbali."
"Complaining son of a bitch,"
Ollie put in promptly.
"Bad sore loser,"
Kittering's translator declared.
"Drank too much," Chris added. "Couldn't keep money,"
Idris rounded up. Rollo nodded. Satisfied conventions were being followed.
"My son, he was. My brother. Loyal to his ship and safe hands. Died in orbit. Who should have died in space, where he belonged. One of ours, he was."
And they chorused, "One of ours," with Solace a beat behind, caught out.
"Asset Medvig 99622, the captain went on. "Instanced 116 after, and provided to us under a medium duration leash contract out of Peace Hive 3.
"Bad sense of humour," Chris said.
"Finicky standoffish type,"
Idris followed.
"Never put my stuff back where it belonged," growled Ollie. "Very expensive to maintain,"
Kit contributed.
"My children they were, and comrades,"
Rollo said.
"Good company and safe hands. Died amongst us who should have gone back to their own. But they were ours."
"They were ours," the chorus came back to Rollo, and Chris saw tears making their tortuous way down the creases on his face. Safe hands. For colonial spacers, whose lives were strung from one mechanical failure to the next, for whom there would never be enough replacement parts, and every little thing might be made to serve as something else just to get them into port, it was the greatest valediction.
"Now," Rollo said quietly, hands on the table, "in this time of grief, I have a favour to ask of you, my daughter."
And he looked Chris in the eye.
"Oh, I know," she agreed. "I'm on it, Captain. I will find out who the hell those waste makers were."
Rollo's smile was bleak. What, after all, could they do with the information? A handful of spacers who didn't even have a ship. But if all they could do was spread word to their peers, they'd do that. Chris stood to go, shaking her sleeve slightly to make sure her dueling knife was hanging right. For a moment, she thought to ask Solace to accompany her. You couldn't get better backup than a Partheni soldier. The woman looked distracted, though, and Chris wondered if she was planning to leave them soon. Instead, she glanced at Ollie.
"Oh, yes," the remote specialist said. "Wouldn't miss it."
"Bring the scorpion," Chris told her. "Stay back. Don't loom, but bring it."
and if they actually met any of the symbiont's confederates, Ollie would ensure they properly rued the day. Chris had done this sort of thing before. It was a development of the work she'd carried out as a student lawyer back on Scintilla, when the thought of a spacer's life would have set her laughing hysterically. Students did the beat work on senior advocates' cases, investigating witnesses, digging up dirt, which meant getting their hands dirty. She hit the Lungcrow's Kybernet with her credentials until she found a way in, then set automated seekers into the station's records. Next, she and Ollie went around the docks, talking to spacers and the orbital's ground crew. Where people recognised her ship name, she took their sympathy and used it ruthlessly. The rest of the time she played whatever role seemed most apt. Creditor, debtor, abandoned lover, old friend. Always her queries circled the identity of the Tothiat. Perhaps a Tothiat who palled around with a vermiform castigar with a beweaponed headmount. The station records gave her some detail on Tothiats as a class. None of it good. They were from the Hegemony. The actual Tothir, the insect thing, was technically a subject race of the Essiel. You didn't see them much outside a fish tank off-world, because they were very dependent on their planet's chemistry. However, the Essiel had many ingenious subordinates, and someone had felt it worth putting a great deal of effort into giving the nasty little critters the freedom of the universe. The solution had been to graft Tothia to other creatures, modified to produce the toxic chemicals the things needed. The results, so she read, had gone some way beyond the hegemonic scientists' intentions. What came off the surgeon's table was neither host nor implant, but a conglomerate personality, seamlessly mixing both. Unsurprisingly, there were few volunteers for the process. On the other hand, Chris discovered grimly, the resulting hybrid had considerable conscious control over the host body's metabolism. The merged creature could push itself far past its usual limits and repair damage very swiftly. They could even survive hard vacuum for an uncomfortably long period of time. A super symbiont. Great. Chris had never expected to end up here. Not the young Kerestina Sulin Almier, who'd won a scholarship to the law schools of Scintilla. She'd been brought up within the Harmaster asteroid belt, home to colossal resource-stripping factories. Her parents had been members in good standing with the iron co-ops, whose collective bargaining and strict union lines had turned poverty and hard graft into relative comfort and affluence by the time Chris was born. Harmaster expats were turning up all over the colonies by then, bringing their work ethics and iron coin bursaries with them. That had been enough to get her onto Scintilla. A lucrative white-collar future had beckoned. Scintilla was difficult, though. The planet was old money rich, like Magda. It had the old families to go with it, those left to their own devices since before Earth fell. It was a cold world, with cities carved into the sides of snow-swept mountains. The older students stalked the sparse high halls of its best law college in black furs. Their junior assistants wore monkish robes and were forbidden to talk in the corridors. And then there was the dueling. It was constrained by all manner of legal restrictions, but students were expected to argue their way out of any repercussions if caught carrying the knife. That was part of the training. And if you didn't carry the knife, you weren't anyone. You could buy the knives legally, train openly, and everyone obsessed over the careers of the top fighters, even the tutors. They harangued their classes on the evils of the atavistic and reprehensible practice, yet their eyes twinkled in encouragement, even as they lectured. And it was hardly ever fatal these days. Chris had picked up the knife because it was plain she'd never walk in the right circles unless she did. She held on to it because she found she loved it. Not the spilled blood, especially if it was hers, but everything else. It was a stupid, aristocratic piece of bravado, yet she turned out to be very good at it. Up to and including the point where she found her knife painted with the life's blood of a very promising young boy of very good family. It hadn't been the legalities that got her, of course. She'd argued her way out of those in a way that would have made her tutors proud. But the family, they wouldn't forget. Vendetta was a serious business amongst the legal dynasties of Scintilla. Life gave her two choices then. Get off planet, or spend her days fending off challenges and assassins. She often wondered if she'd made the right choice, especially now, shipless and penniless.
"We know this individual."
Her benefactor, after a morning's inquiries, was a hiver. This one resembled a metre-tall birdcage, with six evenly spaced legs, and not even the pretense of a head. They were an asset leased to the station dock crew, and Chris suspected they didn't socialise with their human peers much.
"We hear he killed your companions."
"Two crew down and our ship gone," she confirmed, "and we've no idea who they were."
"The absence of knowledge is a wound that will not heal."
This hiver's designation was Yuri, just another random label plucked from a list somewhere.
"Of course, I am not permitted to provide you with confidential station records under the terms of my contract."
Their voice vibrated reedily from the cage of their body. She could see a host of little insects within, whose constant communion produced the conscious entity that called itself Yuri. "Well, look," Chris told them. They were in an abandoned cargo bay, next to a tangle of wiring that the hiver was desultorily repairing. "I can probably work up a good legal argument for why we're entitled to this information, then spend all day getting it past the Kybernet and station admin," she said. "Or I could find the shady outfit I damn well know exists somewhere on board and have them hack the system. But I'd rather take the largesse my factor has made available and transfer it to you. You can't tell me you don't have your own account separate from your leash." Yuri managed a creditable chuckle.
"We won't do it for the money," they said. "Although we will take the money, just to clarify. However, we will do it for your loss. We have looked you up on the tally. Your assets spoke highly of you."
Chris went still, parsing that. Yes, hivers kept a record of who did right by them and who did not. She hadn't ever thought of Medvig doing that. But that was because, to her, Medvig had been people.
"Your Tothiat goes by the name of Mesmon. He shipped in aboard the Sark. The Sark itself departed peaceably after your ship was taken, not connected by security with the theft. Mesmon seems a spacer freelancer, but to one who has worked here under leash for many years, patterns become clear. He is a sworn man with the Broken Harvest Society."
"Ah," said Chris heavily, taking that in. The mob. She had been expecting nativists, maybe, opposing Sathiel's cult, perhaps even Hugh Spooks. Yet the vulture god had been stolen from them by actual thieves. It was nothing personal, was her guess. Nobody on the crew had tangled with the Broken Harvest, as far as she was aware. She set her covert search agents in motion once more, and precious little they brought back was good. It looked as though Broken Harvest operated in the hegemony as much as in the colonies. If they'd taken their prize across the border, or rather, deeper into hegemonic space now, the Vulture's crew would be powerless to intervene. She took a meagre lunch with Ollie in a nearby canteen and went over what she'd found. The remote specialist nodded. Her capsule opened up so she could feed herself with the scorpion's smaller arms.
Where's the Sark out of?
Registered in a place called Gmurk or something, in the hegemony. Not that it means anything, Chris told her. Ollie frowned, chewing mechanically.
And if we knew where they'd gone, what then?
Depends where that was. Maybe we could go after them. Book passage there? I don't know. If we wanted to butt heads with Broken Harvest anyway.
Rollo would, Ollie decided. Rollo is pissed. Don't know if it's the ship or Barney and Med, but is in a mood to cut the throat of God if he has to. What about you?
Chris blinked at her. The throat of God?
Or this Mesmon Triggerman, anyway. Are you ready to do the same?
Chris felt within, and found the same urge that had led to her carrying the knife on Scintilla, now tempered and hardened by two dead friends. Maybe, she allowed.
Then let me link to the station and I'll show you a trick.
Ollie gave her a fierce smile. It was simple, really. Chris almost laughed when she found out. It was the packet trade. Everyone carried news after all. That was how word travelled from one planet to another through Unspace. Everyone made a little money on the side by downloading encrypted communications to deliver at their destination. But to do so, you had to say where you were going. The Vulture God had obviously not taken on packets in its violent exit from Luncrow. On the other hand, the Sark, given its innocent departure, had. It was just what you did when you travelled, natural as breathing, second nature to any crew. The Sark crew had taken on the packet for Tarakuma. Maybe it had been an elegant piece of misdirection. Maybe they weren't even heading for the same destination as the stolen Vulture. But it was all they had to go on.